Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kiley.
I'm Josh Hughes.
I'm Judah Sanders.
And this is Engage in Culture, a podcast presented by Verjoy Christian Church. On today's episode, we welcome speaker, podcaster, and author Arlene Pellicane to the program to talk about her new book, Making Marriage Easier, How to Love and Like Your Spouse for Life. You're going to enjoy the interview. You'll enjoy the book even more. And we'll have a little fun along the way here on Engaging Culture. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the second episode in the month of December on this here Engaging Culture podcast.
Woo.
Here we are, Josh and Judah.
Isn't that
good to
nice.
See you? We have a great guest today.
That's true.
By the way.
That's facts.
And we just need to get through this opening segment so that our dear listeners can enjoy what Arlene has to say.
I got to be one of the few males at the women's Christmas celebration this last week.
Which Arlene was speaking at. Yes.
And she's fantastic.
Yeah. She is terrific. So we want to get to her. So let's do this. Best thing you saw this week, Josh.
We have a new staff person on my team, and while that's not always the best thing, yes, we're happy to have her. One of the funny things that comes out of our meetings is that we all mock each other's habits and tendencies quite a bit.
This is in the communications department.
And so,
because we would never end discipleship.
And I just spilled my coffee. I'm glad I didn't say anything inappropriate.
I was not sure. I was holding my breath.
I spilled coffee.
I want to be clear that there is no such thing as karma.
No.
However.
However.
It was fun. Anyway, you mock each other. Fine.
We mock each other. And one of our dear ladies, Courtney Landry, she does this little thing where she says, woo.
Yes, I'm familiar.
And she doesn't recognize how often she does it. And she doesn't mean it like super sarcastically, but it comes off as incredibly sarcastic. And it's just one of the joys of being on a team that likes each other.
Yep.
Is that you get to poke fun at these things and she's laughing about it. We're laughing about it. And so now it's a thing that we will all look at her randomly in a meeting and go, woo.
And now the new person in your department
is learning that
right
culture
away.
And she's just diving right on in. It's really, really fun.
All right. Well, next time I make it to your side of the office, I'll be sure to woo. Judah, how about you?
So I'm going to do two. The first is that the Honorable Dr. Bishop Parnell Lovelace, PhD, is the interim president at Jessup University.
How
which
about that?
I think is a game changer for the institution. But he's also just like such an inspiration to me. And it's just really cool to see how he has navigated his professional life. And I'm just excited for him and excited for the university. So that's one of the things. The second thing is on November 14th, I decided to pull my life together and like start taking charge of my health again. And as of today, I have lost 18 pounds.
Ooh, but in a month?
In a month.
Holy moly.
I found him if you want him back.
But I don't thank you. I've always been generous. But really the flex that I want to make is that I've been like really being creative in how I can create meals of things that I really, really like that are healthy. And this week I made a fantastic mashed potato type dish out of cauliflower.
Oh, yeah.
And it was fantastic.
And you didn't hate it, huh?
And I loved it. It was so good.
Wow.
I also made a banana bread with no carbs and no sugar. And it was also fantastic.
Wow.
So those are my best things.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Look at you.
Fantastic.
Getting
bread.
Healthy. I love it. My best thing is I love that it is Christmas music season. I enjoy Christmas music a great deal. And the good people at Wren Collective put out an album called Christmas in Belfast, which is lots of fun. I recommend the entire thing. But the very first track is called A Christmas Hymn. And I'm setting this up like it's funny. It is not funny. A Christmas hymn. And it is to the tune of Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, which is one of my favorite hymns.
Mine too.
Anyway. And it is beautiful. It is so wonderful. It just is it's obviously very Christ-centered. It's Christmas-themed celebration to the tune of, again, one of my very favorite hymns of all time. And I've just listened to it a ton throughout the last few weeks, and it has really, really blessed me.
So
check it out. A
this.
Christmas hymn, Christmas in Belfast, Wren Collective.
This really surprises me that you love Christmas music. I don't know why. It's not like I think of you as Mr. Scrooge himself, like pre-ghost visits. Like, I just think of you, like, it just surprises me that you like Christmas music, mostly because you also hate certain worship songs.
I was gonna say,
so
he has terrible taste in music. I think this makes a ton of sense. You don't have terrible taste in music. You have terrible taste in worship music. Your R&B playlist is immaculate.
I have wonderful taste in both worship music and all other kinds of music.
You just sit here and lie on the podcast.
Yeah, if I thought it was bad, I would change it.
Yeah.
But I don't like cheesy Christmas music in the same way that I don't like cheesy worship music. But I find a lot of the Christmas song and the kind of classic Christmas songs like deeply meaningful, and I love to sing them, and I think they're really, really beautiful.
Santa Claus is coming to town.
You know, let's lower.
And his name is Brian Kiley. Why? My word, St. Brian Kiley coming to town.
I'll start working on that one. All right, this is enough nonsense from us. Arlene Pelican, you're going to love it. Hope you enjoy it, and we'll be back right after the interview. All right, well, we are back, and I am delighted to welcome to the studio Arlene Pelican. She is a speaker, she is an author, she's the host of the Happy Home podcast. She has spoken at a marriage event at Bridgeway before and in town speaking at last week's women's event, and was kind enough to sit down with me to talk about her new book, Making Marriage Easier. Arlene Pelican, thanks so much for taking some time to talk with me.
I love Bridgeway, so it's fun to be here. Hello, Bridgeway women and everyone else I didn't get to meet at the women's Christmas dessert.
Now, I really enjoyed your book. I told my wife, I said, if you notice me becoming an even more exceptional husband than I already am,
right.
It's because I'm reading this marriage book, which, of course, you know, she rolled her eyes. But more than that, this is my biggest takeaway from your book, is that actually I think your husband and I need to be best friends.
Yes.
And possibly your wife and I might, my wife and you might need to form a support group.
Because
I'm like, this guy drinks weird smoothies. He's into like exercise and fitness and always wants to try 1,000 different things.
Yeah.
That is me. So,
he'd be so happy also to find you, Brian.
Your husband sounds amazing.
Yeah.
So if you could just pass that along to him,
that
big takeaway from the marriage book was, wow, I'm pretty sure we are twins.
We would be friends.
Yeah, it was great. But so much great, just applicable marriage, so many great applicable marriage principles I found throughout the book. But I want to ask you, first of all, just about the title, Making Marriage Easier, How to Love and Like Your Spouse for Life. Why easier?
Yeah.
Why choose that word?
I didn't want to say making marriage easy,
right?
Because it is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted something that would resonate with people. And your publisher kind of works with you with this as well. So you kind of as a team sit down and you realize, okay, this is, people need a little hope of how can I make this easier? Because people are saying, oh, it's so hard.
Yeah.
It's so hard. Like, why does it have to be so hard? So that is kind of what the book wants to answer. Why does it have to be so hard?
Yeah.
Is there a way we could make this easier? And I love the idea of, like, we love our spouse, but sometimes we don't like our spouse. So how do we love them and how do we like them? And the idea of easier is, you know, if I say, okay, I want to be healthier, so now I'm just going to be healthy, but I don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
But if I say, I'm going to go to this neighborhood spin class with my mother twice a week and do the spin class with our neighbor, which we have done for 21 years now.
It's amazing.
It makes it easy because I don't have to think about it.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, what do? I paid money for it. I'm, you know, connected to it. So it just made exercise easy because it made it a commitment. It gave it the clarity, added my mother to the mix. So how in marriage can we make, like, specific gains?
Yeah.
How can we make connecting with each other easier?
And you kind of outlined the book into four decisions.
Yeah.
And underneath each of those four, there were kind of some specific commitments.
Yes.
Talk to me about that way of thinking through, because it kind of relates to what you were saying about, okay, making some decisions regarding the spin class to create health. I got to imagine that's kind of the same concept in terms of marital health here.
Yeah, it is the idea that, okay, what's my mindset? What are the choices that I'm making? And so as James and I were looking at, you know, we've been married almost 27 years now and thinking, okay, how has this been kind of fun?
Yeah.
like not awful. How has this happened? And looking through, we saw, okay, the first decision was we played by the rules, that there's clarity. There's certain things we do and we don't do. We are thankful. We give thanks for our spouse instead of being like, oh my goodness, if I only had a different spouse, right? Grumbling. We serve one another. Because when you go in thinking, what are you going to do for me today? I've done a whole lot more for you than you've done for me. Like, you just lose.
Yeah.
And then that fourth decision was to have fun, that it was the fun that started the whole thing, but it's the fun that that phases out the fastest.
Yeah.
So how can you keep that fun, not just with your kids, because that naturally kind of happens, but how do you keep having fun with your spouse?
Right. Yeah. It's so important and easy to neglect. As
very easy. Yeah.
Life is serious. Lots going on, raising kids, but so important. I want to ask you about kind of some specific things you mentioned in the book, which just kind of to preface all of these questions, I think something I appreciated and one of the reasons why I really recommend this book to others is I finished every chapter kind of going either, okay, yeah, I feel like maybe I'm doing that, or things where I felt like, oh, I could probably step things up in this area.
Yeah.
It didn't feel Herculean. It was like,
yes,
oh yeah, I could do that.
Yeah.
I could probably get better at being thankful.
Totally.
I could probably get better at not, you know, taking that initiative to be the one who serves first. Like, okay, this feels...
And then think of that. That was doable. But let's say you wake up tomorrow and your spouse takes a step to serve you. You're going to be like, wait, what's happening? Like, right? It's this little tiny thing, but it shifts you together. It makes you closer together.
Early in the book, you talk about the importance of sharing meals together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a huge advocate for that myself and really try our best in our family to practice that. But I'd love to hear from you. What has made that practice so valuable for you and your husband and really you and your whole family?
Yes. We all have to eat. So it's an easy habit, right? So from the very beginning, when we were first married, my husband had this really weird request. I was working as a television producer at the time. And he said, in our first month of marriage, could we not have a television? Because at the end of the day, I want us to like talk to each other and do stuff together and do activities. I don't want us just to like sit around on the couch and like watch TV. Mm-hmm. That sounds really lame to me. And I thought,
I like him even better.
Right,
go
right?
on.
And then I was like, what a strange person that you don't want to watch television. You know what I mean? So we decided that. But what it did was it began, and that was the brilliance of my husband, is it set this habit of, oh, at the end of the day, we eat together. We're not distracted.
Yeah.
We talk about each other's day. After the meal, you feel connected. You feel reconnected, all those things. And it really stuck. So having a daily meal, and of course, if someone's out of town, something weird happens, that's fine.
Right.
But that it would feel weird if you're having dinner, but why are we not together?
Yeah.
You know, that's what you need to get to. Because today we are all like, oh, she has to go to soccer, picking her up from ballet. Here's a sandwich. See you later. And you don't eat together.
Yeah.
So it's really important because one day goes by and you miss a meal, two days, 3 days. And now you've done 3 days of not really talking or connecting.
Yeah.
And it's really easy to feel disconnected. So I feel like it's a bit of an endangered species, the family dinner time, because families, we just come, we get the food. One person's doing homework. One person's watching a movie. One person's like, okay, good. I'll watch the news then. Okay, I'll do this. It's like we think, oh, great. Now I can do my individual thing.
Yeah.
But we're missing connecting with each other. So for my husband and I, having that time where, you know, it's not a question. It's like every evening we're going to put a salad on the table. We're going to make a meal. We're going to, it could be a very simple meal, but we're going to sit and talk to each other. And if you have kids in the home, obviously they're part of that too.
Yeah. What would you say to the family who would maybe say, gosh, it just feels like nobody tried, but now we're to this point where, the family meal is an endangered species in our household. And it certainly doesn't feel realistic to kind of go, all right, boom, we're going to swing the pendulum back here. Are there like simple steps that families can take to start to go, okay, what, once a week, twice a week, how do we start to make this happen?
So let's just start with once a week.
Yeah.
Let's pick a night, like Thursday night, that's family night. And you kind of look at everyone's schedule and you say, okay, Thursday night's going to work. Let's do it. And then it's non-negotiable.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't care what's happening at work, whatever. If it's just one time a week that you're starting with, that is family dinner night.
Yeah.
And then once you get one under your belt, then maybe it's, okay, Saturday, we'll have breakfast together.
Yeah.
And then you add like, oh, Sunday, let's have dinner together. And so now you're adding, so maybe now you're having three meals a week together, and now you've got a good effect going, and you just want to eat more and more, because all the research shows that if you will eat together with your family, you have all these protective measures, right?
Yeah.
Because they're connecting. Now they find belonging in their family, like your kids and your spouse, instead of finding belonging with a chatbot, finding belonging at a bad peer group for your kids.
Yeah.
So academically, drugs, all those things. It's going to be positive just by coming together and having a meal together. Right.
Yeah, the research on that is wild, how beneficial it can be, especially for young people. Now, in your chapter about communication, I loved this phrase. You said, what is mentionable is manageable. What does that mean? And maybe what does it not mean in terms of couple communication?
And I have to throw that back to Mr. Rogers. It came from him. But it's the idea of, oh, I can't talk about that. Hmm. Like, we can't talk about money.
Yeah.
I can't talk about sex. I can't talk about like gaining weight. Oh my goodness, for sure. Don't talk about that, you know, or health or being scared about something or worry or anything. Like, I can't talk about that. And then it becomes this bigger thing, like something that could be small if you would just bring it to the light.
Yeah.
And instead it's like, oh, I'm not going to talk about that. Yeah. So if you can mention it, then you can manage it. Mm-hmm. So how do we get to this point? It really is cultivating like a safety that you kind of tell yourself, hey, well, no matter what my spouse says to me, I need to first say thank you for saying that to me. Yeah. Like, you might want to say, I can't believe you did that. How could you think that? You know what? Yeah. You're right. But instead, the culture of the home being, hey, you know what? I don't fully agree with you, but thank you for sharing that with me. Let me think about that. And then let's talk about, let's say it's a real hot issue and it's like, wow. And then, hey, let me talk about, or it could be like, hey, thanks for talking. Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
And then you can talk about it.
I think about oftentimes at the church, people come up to me with some sort of a complaint or gripe or something that they're not happy about. And I am always very careful to thank them because number one, I'd rather them tell me than walk away grumbling.
Right.
Number two, and I tell them this, I say, if you talk to me about it, I can potentially do something about it. And now there are times when I feel like the complaint is ridiculous, but I'm still glad they told me.
Right.
I'm still glad we could at least have a conversation.
Yeah.
And now I recognize sometimes in our intimate relationships that can be a little bit harder.
Yeah.
But I think to develop that discipline of going, if my spouse shares something that feels vulnerable to them,
yes,
even if it is hard for me to hear, even if it is offensive, to kind of try to not freak out, right?
Yes.
To keep those lines of communication open. Yeah. I got to think that's really important.
And it may be as simple as holding their hand, like they said something hard to you and you feel like that's weird or whatever, but even just reaching over, holding their hand while they're saying it to you, it makes them feel like, oh, you're listening.
Yeah, which is huge. Speaking of listening, I'm really not happy to say how much I resonated, Arlene, with your discussion of problematic listening styles.
What did you say? I'm not listening.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So can you briefly tell us about the assumptive listener, the fixer? And I loved this. I'd heard those two. I had never heard of the celebrity listener, but it's so perfect. Can you tell us about those three? And then maybe a little bit of like, how can we stop listening that way?
We tend to think we are good listeners and my spouse is not a good listener, but I surely am a good listener. And I really thought that about myself.
Uh-huh.
And I realized, oh my goodness, I am the assumptive listener, which basically means I'm going to assume what James is going to say and I'm going to interrupt him. So he's going to say, oh, I saw so-and-so and I'm going to say, oh, they went to the fair, didn't they? Because I know that she went to the fair. And he's like, no. I bet they want to talk to you about their, you know, dishwasher that broke. No. Would you like to try again? So that's his famous comment to me. He'll say, would you like to try again? And he's trying to say, am I not telling the story? Can you just please listen?
Yeah.
And in my mind, I'm trying to show, oh, I'm listening. Like, I know what you're going to say. And so I've had to really realize, please do not assume that you know what the other person's going to say. Just keep your mouth shut and let them finish saying it. So that's the assumptive listener. Just be quiet and listen and don't try to tell the story for the other person. The fixer listener, you know, stereotypically the man is going to fix the wife. The wife is going to be like, oh, I have this fight with my friend. I'm so sad. And the man's going to say, okay, here's what you need to do. You need to talk to her about this. Then you need to apologize about this. And then why don't you go to coffee and buy her this? And the wife is going to say, I didn't want you to fix it. I just wanted you to listen. So the idea there is, hey, do you want me to offer you a solution? Or do you want me just to listen?
Yeah.
Because sometimes we really do need a solution, but most of the time we just want you to listen. So the fixer. Yeah. The celebrity is like, hey, I'm going to always shift the conversation back to me. So if you're talking to me about a camping trip, oh my goodness, that's nothing. Wait till you hear about my camping trip. Or, oh, you had that teacher. Oh, I had that teacher too. This is what that teacher said to me. So you're always shifting back the spotlight to yourself. You are the celebrity. Now, there's a fine line because you could be sharing because you're saying like, hey, I'm trying to relate to you.
Sure.
I'm trying to go back and forth. But the idea of the celebrity is that you are always trying to bring the conversation back to that you are the one in control of it. So you can picture like a halo around the head of the person who is talking, your spouse, let's say, and say, oh, they are the celebrity right now. Let me let them shine and let them have this full moment with me, not just the whole time they're talking, thinking, how can I shift this back to myself?
I remember years ago, the very first time I watched the comedian Brian Regan, if you're familiar with him, like his like earliest video special, he has a whole thing about why do we beat each other stories. And that has stuck with me this entire time.
Yeah.
And even in sharing this anecdote, I'm like, am I celebrity listening right now? I don't know. But like there is that sense of going, yes, you hear someone share about their camping trip and like this, it's like going to explode if you don't talk about your own camping trip. And at the, I don't know. I try at the very least to be like, oh yeah, I've been there as well. Okay, tell me more about your trip. To at least like get it out and then go back.
But and I think it's okay to say your trip, but then like bring it back to the other person.
Yeah.
Or I think the length. Let's say they told their trip in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And now you're talking about your trip for 10 minutes. It's like, oh my goodness, give it back to them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, those are obviously three different problematic ways of listening. So I don't know that there's necessarily a silver bullet to go, here's how you avoid all of them.
Yeah.
But are there some strategies that maybe you've utilized or that you recommend that can help us listen better?
Quiet is truly like simply they're talking and I'm going to be quiet.
That's I don't want to do that.
Yeah, I don't want to do that. So all it is just like when someone is talking, to be quiet. So that honestly is a big thing because I'm an interrupter.
Yeah,
right.
Me
like
too.
I will interrupt. So I have to be like, okay, please do not interrupt. Let them finish talking. I think the curiosity. So if someone, especially your spouse, right? Because you're with them all the time, you see them, you know them. So you're really not that curious. You're just kind of like, get it out so we can go on to the next thing. So to really try like, oh, really? Tell me more about that.
Yeah.
So I think not being in a rush, that would be huge because we are in a rush. Like, tell me the thing so I can go to my next thing.
Yeah.
But if, what if over that dinner that we're having, hey, tell me more about that. How did you feel when that happened? What'd you think about that? Whoa, what choice did you make? Like, be interested, follow up with questions.
Yeah. No, that's so good. And you're right. Gosh, we're so hurried. We're so self-involved. Yeah. But I mean, listening to another person is such a profound way to show love for them. And I think, you know, how can I show my spouse I love them? In some ways, it's like, okay, sit down, shut up, and just care.
How much easier, right, would your marriage be if your spouse was like, oh, really? Tell me more about that.
Oh.
I mean, it's that simple.
And it's almost jarring if you're not used to it.
Right? And then be like, wow, you want to know about me? You're not in a hurry? Like, that could be just that really small change that makes it easier this week.
Now, you mentioned this a little bit ago, but the theme of the first part of the book was this idea of playing by the rules. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people find rules, especially in the context of relationships, very scary or, oh, I'm being constrained or, oh, someone's trying to control me or whatever. And unfortunately, like there's a legitimacy to that, right?
Sure.
Like that can certainly happen. But why have you and James found rules to be important? And kind of what have you done to maximize the benefit of having rules without sliding into some of those more harmful places that rules can take
us? We're not talking about legalism. We're not talking about doing anything immoral. We are talking about if you play a game, our family plays Ultimate Frisbee on Sunday afternoons. Mm-hmm. If you play a game and then it's like, oh, look, the goals changed. Oh, wow, we're on different teams now. Oh, now we score points a different way. Like, it would not be fun to play.
Mm-hmm.
So rules in a marriage make it fun to play the game. Like, there's clarity. That's what we're talking about. There's clarity. So if you're not, you know, and there will be some rules that are the same for every couple.
Sure.
Please do not cheat on me. Do not lie.
Yeah.
Let's not go $1 million into debt. You know, there's a lot of rules that are very commonplace that everyone would have.
Yeah.
But then there might be other rules. You know, I think about my mentors, Bill and Pam Farrell. They grew up with yelling parents.
Hmm.
So they made it a rule. We are not going to yell.
Hmm.
Right. So there are things that you will decide as a couple. Hey, for us, it was like, we're going to have a meal every day.
Yeah.
You know, so have those things that this is how we play the game of marriage.
Yeah.
And this is how we can keep playing for the long term, because it's a good rule. So that's obviously very important. Don't put dumb rules
rules that actually help.
Put good rules, you know, so that that would be something that would help you. And it might be as simple as, hey, we're going to have a getaway. Make sure, especially during the really busy child rearing years, like, hey, we're going to get away for at least 24 hours once a year, you know, and that could be a rule that is very helpful in your marriage.
Yeah. Now, I can imagine someone listening to this going, okay, that sounds great, but what if we make rules and my spouse breaks them? And I'm not talking about the, like, don't cheat on me type rules, but things like, we said we weren't going to yell and you yelled, and now I don't feel safe to talk to you about it.
Yes.
And this could go 100 different ways, but what would you say to that person who's maybe nervous about trying this for
reason? This is life, and don't be afraid. Yeah. If you just figure, hey, let's not do that because we're going to mess up, then you're not going to go anywhere. You're not going to get anywhere. But like, hey, let's shoot for the moon. And if we don't make it, at least we got like a lot further.
Yeah.
So it's okay if you mess up. Then that's the opportunity. Hey, forgive me. I didn't show up for dinner. This happened. Hey, let's try again tomorrow.
Yeah.
So that really is the heart of it, right? Mm-hmm. In marriage, it's like we're going to keep trying to give our best to this person, but we're going to fail. And then we're just going to say sorry, and we're going to reset, and we're going to start again.
Yeah.
So not to feel like, oh, I can't live up to this. I think that's a lie the enemy uses, that, hey, let me not try this if I know I'm going to fail at it. Like, no, go for something. Yeah. Have a goal in your marriage, you know, something to shoot for.
And I also can't help but think that I think sometimes these failures, if when they occur, you use the phrase like, oh, I'm sorry. You used it a couple of times there. If we just acknowledge, hey, I didn't live up to my commitment here. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That can actually be a bonding agent. Whereas so often, I mean, my goodness, I'm embarrassed that I've been guilty of this. Like, we get caught having done something wrong, and it's immediate defensiveness, right?
Sure.
And I mean, I always tell people, your defensiveness is lying to you. Like, it is not here to help you.
Right.
So I think for each of us to just go, all right, I want to own it when I miss the mark. I imagine that's just got to be a much healthier way to approach those things.
Totally, right? And that's maturing us as believers. It's helping our marriage if we say, hey, I overspent, and I just didn't mean to do that, and I know that was not good, and here's what I'm going to do in the future to fix that.
Yeah. Another part that I really enjoyed was, I mean, you told a lot of stories about, you know, you and James and the different things you do together, and some interest that he has and some interest that you have, and there's not necessarily alignment, but that you've fostered a real openness to trying things that each other's into. And you have this motto, if you like it, I'll try it. Why have you found that to be helpful, and kind of what does that mean?
It's been a lot of fun. My husband is super athletic, and I am not, right?
Okay.
So I'm the girl who, like, didn't want to go on the sixth grade trip because it was a bike trip. And it was like, I couldn't stay on a bike for that long. Like, I'm going to have an excuse and be sick, right? And then my husband is the complete opposite. So all the things he likes to do are pretty active. Mm-hmm. So they were all things I had to learn. I would get these Christmas presents. It would be ice skates. What am I going to do with these? One year it was rollerblades. What am I going to do with these? One year it was a martial arts gi because we're doing jiu-jitsu. So it was really like, oh my goodness. So I adopted this motto. Okay, if you like it, I'll try it. Mm-hmm. So my husband, it's been a lot of fun, and it puts a lot of fun in our marriage because my husband will say, like, oh yeah, she's not really great at those things, but you know what she's really good at? She's a really good sport. Like, my wife will totally try it. Like, she will be there. She'll be all lame, but but she will be there. And that has really served me well. So instead of just saying, like, well, I don't do that, because when you're dating, you totally do what the other person, just because you want to be with them.
Yeah.
You don't care. It's a football game. It's shopping. It's antique shopping. It's watching a horse race. Whatever it is, you might hate it. But if they're there, you love it because you want to be with them. And then you get married, and then all of a sudden you stop doing all these things because you're like, I don't want to do that. But it has to continue. Hey, you know what? If you really like this thing, I will try it. And if I don't absolutely hate it, I'll do it with you.
Yeah.
But if I absolutely like skiing, my family loves skiing. I have tried to ski many a ski trip, and we finally have come to the point, you guys ski, mom will drink coffee, and I will see you at lunch. And that just works so much better for everyone. So there is if you like it, I'll try it. And then sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Sure. I got to imagine, though, that openness and not just rejecting things out of hand has probably saved you guys a lot of conflict and brought you together in some neat
ways.
And
it goes both ways.
Yeah.
Because then, right, so then my husband would be like, he doesn't drink coffee, for instance. I'd love to go to coffee shops and love drinking coffee, and he will genuinely enjoy it just because he wants to spend time with me. So I just order coffee. He orders nothing. And we just sit there. So, you know, it's just an openness to, like, hey, I want to do the things you like.
Yeah, I love it. Now, you've done a lot of work around technology, and folks, if they visit your website, they can find your books on the topic and everything else. It's obviously a huge potential source of stress in a lot of marriages. But I think it's also one of those topics that we're a little bit afraid to talk to each other about the phone use and TV use.
Because if I talk to you about your use, then you get to talk to me about my use.
Yes.
And we don't want to go there.
No.
So we just stay doing what we're doing.
Yes. Are you reading my mind right now? But but I do think, obviously, technology can really interfere with times of, I don't mean just sex, but just intimate times that couples can have one-on-one where a phone is now around, or, oh my gosh, what do we even do as a family apart from a screen? Or maybe I'm trying to like avoid and put my phone away, but my spouse still has theirs out. But it can be a very touchy subject to talk about.
Yeah.
Certainly one that can provoke a lot of defensiveness. Yeah. I'm preaching to the choir here, I know. But what are some tips that you can give us to have healthier conversations with our spouse specifically about the role technology plays in our home?
Is your spouse more interesting than your phone? So when you were dating, you would definitely say yes. Mm-hmm. Now, let's be real. No, how could they be? Your phone is literally created by Silicon Valley and a gazillion brain scientists, psychologists, gambling, everything to show you exactly what you want with zero limitations. We don't have to wait for anything. You've got your dopamine going. So you just need to realize this is not fair to say like, well, this is very boring talking to my spouse. So I'm just going to pick up my phone. It's just not fair. It's like you cannot compare the two. And especially as you introduce AI, someone who is, and I by one, I use that loosely, a thing that is going to watch you all the time. And know exactly what brings you anxiety, what makes you angry, what have you bought lately, what are you thinking about today? They know because they're watching all your keystrokes. Your spouse cannot keep up with you like that.
Yeah.
And when this AI says, I support you, everything you do is great, you're awesome, you're amazing, what are we going to talk about today? And then you have this real life spouse that's like, ugh. You're going to be like, oh, I'm going to choose the AI. So we in this day and age have to be super careful to realize I need to be connected to my human spouse. Mm-hmm. And I need to realize I need to set some really firm guardrails around if I find like, wow, I'm chatting to my AI like way too much. Like, hey, I need to stop that. Like maybe I need to go back to typing into it and stop talking to it because I'm starting to be like, wow, you're a lot easier to talk to than my husband or my wife.
Yeah.
So that's going to be a huge thing. Thinking of like if you're on a date and you have a phone, right? And then one person gets a text and they check the text and then you look, oh, you're on the phone. Then you grab your phone and now both of you are on your phones. And then 5 minutes later, you're like, oh, wait, we're supposed to be talking to each other. So I think simple rules like, okay, no phones on the table. That's very helpful. And just think of it like you would never have another woman at the table.
Right.
Like you're eating steak and there's another woman right there.
Yeah.
So you would never have that. But you have this phone who's going to want to talk to you more effectively than even a human woman would.
Right.
So to really get a bit hostile towards that phone in terms of your relationship to say, I will not let you be the third person. I'm not going to let my marriage get broken up by an inanimate object. You know what I mean? So this is like guarding dates. This is guarding like the first the bookends of your day, the mornings and the evenings.
Yeah.
So if we can get to the place where we're charging our phones away from us, where it's not the last thing we see at night, the first thing we see in the morning, and we're more connected to God and then connected to the human being in our room, which is our spouse, that would go a long way.
Yeah. It's wild to me how difficult I think making phone adjustments are at first, but how freeing they become. I'm not a poster child for phone health by any stretch, but even, I don't know, it's been probably a year since I moved my phone downstairs.
Oh, wow.
And that first week, it was like,
Where is it?
Oh my gosh, what is happening?
It's so far away.
And now you realize, I don't see my phone until I've had time to connect with God, until I've had time to just breathe and wake up. And if I'm, oh, I can't sleep. All right, I'm not reaching for the phone to scroll. I'm like, all right, well, we'll do something else other than that.
Yeah.
But then you realize like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a second. I'm better off here.
Totally.
How have you navigated And this is getting into more some of your other work, but maybe just one question about this. I mean, how have you navigated that with your children who are now, they're grown now, is that right?
Yeah, I have one in high school, one in college, and one after college.
So how did you kind of navigate?
Yeah, so this is huge.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's environment, you know, so instead of just willpower all the time, just like, oh, look, you don't have a phone, you don't have a tablet, please go play outside. So honestly, we did the hard now, easy later route, which is the, hey, let's do this different. And now all the science is out, right? So you look at John Haidt, you look at the Anxious Generation. Now we have a huge swath of parents who now understand, oh, wow, video gaming and social media and an iPad in my five-year-old's hand for 10 hours a day. Wow, that's going to be bad. We are getting that.
Yeah.
So the big decision we made was no social media, no video games, no personal devices all the way through high school.
Okay.
And we are a very technology heavy family. So we have our kids editing my podcast, for instance, or, you know, Ethan 3D printing Nerf guns and selling them in high school. So we were not anti-technology, like make music on it, you know, watch a YouTube video to learn something. But then that's it. Like it's a common area thing for learning, but it's not in your pocket. It's not yours. And never social media.
Yeah.
And I can, you know, you can read Screen Kids to find out, you know, what's, why did we do that? What's happening in the brain? I'm working on a new book also on this topic. And then if listeners go to happyhomeuniversity.com, they can watch a little documentary we did asking the kids, what was it like being in high school without video games? Were you left out because you weren't on social media? And, you know, that's something free that families can watch.
The social media component, I mean, you obviously know this.
Yeah.
Just the research is unambiguous about the harm it does to young people. And even, you know, my two boys are 14 and 12. And I've told them, I've just said, I'm sorry to tell you, you've got lame parents who know the research and you're not getting social media.
Yeah, guess what?
Because
you get to be healthy.
It harms you. Right. Yeah. What's wild is even like so many other places where even things like, you know, YouTube reels or short things.
Right.
And I try to tell them like, okay, these things are not bad because they're bad.
Yeah.
They're bad because they're great.
Yes.
They are more entertaining than anything else in the world.
That's
and it kind of goes back to what
it.
You were saying about
That's
how your phone is so interesting, but it can pull you away from your spouse and real life and touching grass and just
all those things.
I don't know.
It's so true.
Yeah.
It's so true.
Last thing. I really enjoyed the last part of your book talking about fun. I love to have fun. I just, you know, whatever. I like to make jokes out of things. Life is serious. Let's go out and have a good time. I'm the wife calls me the steam engine that drives our crazy train.
I love
if we're gonna go out and do something, it was probably my idea.
That's right.
Why is it important, first of all, for couples to have fun together?
Yes. It's what brought you together, right? Yeah. So when you think about it, it's like, oh, I like being with this person. Well, why do you like being with them? Well, they could be a good listener. They could be comforting. But a lot of it is you have fun together, right? You think this person is funny. You find the same things funny. You do things together and enjoy it. So I think we can fall into the trap of thinking that's something we'll do later when we have money, when we have time, when our kids are grown. But then if you go through a decade and you think we never had fun, like we stopped doing that, then that's not going to be good. So a good question is to ask, like, when was the last time you laughed together?
Yeah.
When was the last time you did something fun together? And if it takes a really long time to figure that out, then you'll know, okay. So for James and I, it might be as silly as like, you know, you listen to a podcast and you find the same thing funny and you laugh about it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, our newest thing is ballroom dancing and
nice.
Neither of us are good at it, right? But we were taking classes and we're doing it and it is fun, like when you waltz together around in a room. The first time we did it, believe me, it was not fun at all. It was ridiculous. But we've been doing it for a few years now. And now when we go around a room, you know, we don't quite look like Belle and the Beast, but it's fun.
Yeah.
Like it's really fun.
Yeah.
So finding something, you know, in the book, Making Marriage Easier, there's a really long list of activities. So I encourage, you know, look at it and you'll probably find, you know, one or two that both of you would say, I could find that fun and just start there.
I loved that list. I'm glad you brought it up. I was going to mention it because you're right. You give all these activities to just, and kind of the sense was
just
right.
To think
you just sort of go, okay, which of these would you be open to?
Exactly.
And I got to imagine we would probably find more resonance with our spouse than maybe we think we would.
Yes.
Yeah. One more thing on this. What did fun look like maybe earlier on,
yeah.
Because I can imagine for folks who either, I mean, certainly I remember just starting out and you have no money, or you got little kids and it's, wow, a dance class sounds great, but, you know, I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
What did fun look like for you and James earlier on?
Isn't that funny? Because it could just be being together.
Yeah.
It's like you go to the grocery store. Yay, this is fun. I remember we went to his parents lived in town, and we went to his parents' house and we were refinishing a table from their attic. Yeah. And it was like that. It's like those movies, like those Hallmark movies where you're laughing together and you have the belt sander and you have like the glasses and it's so, and it really was fun. And it's just, I think whatever you were doing was so fun because you're together. And that's why I think you can bring that same fun to that same home project. Now it's not fun, but it could be fun.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. And you know, you do the movies and you go out to plays and you go to athletic events. We did a lot of biking. I was a terrible biker, so he was teaching me how to bike. We'd go on the, you know, beach. We were in Virginia beaches where we were going to school, and we'd walk along the beach. So there were, like, of course, these fun things that you do. And you go out to ice cream. And, you know, he would go to Dairy Queen whenever there was a Blizzard coupon.
Excellent.
So I think even just doing those things now.
It seems almost like adopting a perspective of sort of fun is there if you're willing to look for it a little bit.
Yeah.
Because so many of the things you described, they either can be fun or not.
And they can be small.
Yeah.
Because I feel like now it doesn't mean like, oh, it has to be so expensive. It can be a small thing. Like we just went, we had a gift certificate. So we're like, let's use our gift certificate. So we went out to Indian food and my husband wrapped up a gift. I like gifts. I'm like, the gifts is one of my love languages. So I get this wrapped thing, right? And I'm like, oh, he gave me a wrapped thing. And I'm so excited. And he said, oh, you're getting too exciting. It's a re-gift. Just know that it's a re-gift. So that was good that he like tampered down the expectations. And then it was so funny because I opened it at the date and it's like this couples game, like of questions you can ask each other. But what's funny is, I mean, it was just on our bookshelf. Like, he just took this, and I'm like, this was on our bookshelf.
I love it.
He's like, but I wrapped it. And then we asked a few questions out of it to each other.
It.
And so that was very funny that it's just this little, it's so a lot of it is just being thoughtful of like, what's just like a little thing thoughtful that I can do to show my person that I still care.
Oh my gosh. I love it. And it's again, and what a great example of just the sort of thing that, that I think made this book so rich. And really, we haven't even in this conversation talked very specifically about kind of the spiritual component of all of this, but you just kind of go, God loves marriage and God wants to see our marriages thrive. And certainly there were multiple chapters of the book that dealt very specifically with kind of spiritual topics and how that all plays out. But I just, I mean, all of this is how we connect with our spouse, how we honor the Lord. And it's just super important. So thank you for writing the book. I, you know, lame jokes to my wife aside, I do think it's helped me, and I think it's, and I think I'm better off as
a
result.
And then I love it also because I will tell people, and so Brian can attest to this, because a lot of times who reads the books? It's women.
Right.
Right? So I will say to people, your husband can actually get through this book.
Yes.
Like, it's funny enough. And then James does provide that figure of like, yeah, that's how I would do it.
Yep.
Because I think a lot of times we women, we are too, like, we're the ones who know how to do it. We're relational. And to really see, like, wait, it's like men are different and it's wonderful.
Right.
Like, the leadership that James brings in the marriage and the same thing that you would bring as you read it. So I think it's great that you did.
Yeah. No, I loved it. Now, we'll, of course, link to the book and a bunch of your other stuff in the show notes. But if folks want to connect with you or learn more about what you're doing, where are some of the places they can find you?
Yeah, you can go to my name, ArleenePelicane.com. And then the Happy Home Podcast, as I'm always interviewing people on marriage and parenting. And then if you go to makingmarriageeasier.com, you can listen to the first chapter for free.
All right. There you go. So Making Marriage Easier, How to Love and Like Your Spouse for Life. Grab it wherever you get your books. You'll be glad that you did. Arleen Pelicane, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Brian.
We'll be right back. We are back, and we're going to end this episode, as we often do, with a game, and I have come up with a game for today. Neither of my esteemed co-hosts know what they are getting into. I have not told them.
No.
We are trembling with anticipation.
Well, trembling. I'm afraid.
We're just gonna have a little fun here this morning. No one's getting embarrassed.
We don't believe you.
We're gonna have a good time. I know you don't. It's like when I tell my kids this is gonna be fun.
Yeah, and often,
but
it's
always
not.
Right. So Arlene and I obviously just finished talking about marriage, so we're gonna have some fun with some marriage-related trivia.
What does that have to do with me?
Marriage-related trivia.
What does that have to do with me?
Someday you yourself will be married.
But it is so not this
it
day.
It is helpful for you to know these things. So, first question. And I have 17 amazing questions right here.
I hope we do each one of those very slowly.
Not going to do every single one, but so many of them are so good. All right. In a traditional Swedish wedding, if the groom leaves the room to, like, use the restroom or for any other reason, what are the male guests allowed to do? Is it A, steal his food, B, kiss the bride, or C, hide his chair? Josh.
I really hope it's kiss the bride, because that is dark.
Okay.
The appropriate thing to do is steal his food.
The correct answer is kiss the bride, and it goes both ways. If the bride
what
leaves
culture
the room,
is this?
It's Swedish. Swedish. If the bride leaves the room, the female guests rush to kiss the groom.
Now, honey, this is a joke. Time to go to some weddings in Sweden.
Now,
that's a joke, honey.
All right.
Please don't leave me.
In the Congo, couples must refrain from doing a specific thing during their entire wedding day, from the ceremony to the photos. What is it? Is it A, speaking to each other? Is it B, smiling? Or is it C, eating? Judah.
Speaking to each other.
Smiling.
The correct answer is smiling.
That's wild business.
In this tradition, marriage is considered serious business. If they smile, it implies they are not taking the commitment seriously enough. All right, now we're going to move to some wedding traditions. Historically, why did brides originally carry bouquets of flowers and herbs? Is it A, to ward off evil spirits? Is it B, to mask body odor? Or C, to symbolize fertility?
I mean, didn't they used to not bathe? They probably smell bad. It's probably the smell.
I'm going with fertility.
It is to mask body odor, which I believe now, Judah, you are ahead 3-1. Is that right?
No, it's two to two.
In the 1500s, people didn't bathe often. Weddings were usually in June because people took their yearly bath. Could you imagine?
That's wild business.
Yearly bath in May. By June, they were starting to smell.
I take mine in December. So this is a good month to say hello.
I have noticed you've been smelling nice. So, all right. Mystery writer Agatha Christie famously said, an archaeologist is the best husband a woman can have. What was her reasoning? A, he's used to digging up dirt. B, the older she gets, the more interested he is in her. Or C, he spend months away on dig sites.
Oh, I like C most, but probably B. The older she gets, the more interested he gets in her.
I think I would agree.
That is correct. And Christie herself was married to a prominent archaeologist, so she knows of what she speaks. Next, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg famously said the secret to her long, happy marriage was the advice her mother-in-law gave her on her wedding day. And what is it? Is it A, it helps to be a little deaf, B, never go to bed angry, or C, keep separate bank accounts?
A.
A.
It is absolutely A. She applied this to her job on the Supreme Court as well. Sometimes she said it is best just to tune out the unkind or thoughtless words so you don't snap back.
Shout out to Big Mama Ruth.
That's right. RBG knew what she was talking about. All right.
The notorious RBG.
The notorious RBG. The ancient Greek philosopher Socrates had a rather cynical view on matrimony. He was quoted as saying this, by all means, marry. If you get a good wife, you'll become happy. If you get a bad wife, you'll become, is it A, a philosopher, B, a soldier, or C, a beggar?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I'll probably say philosopher, because that would be him just complaining about his wife.
What is B?
B is a soldier and C is a beggar.
I'm going to say a soldier. Maybe he wants to get away and go fight in the war.
No, the answer is, in fact, a philosopher. Socrates himself was married to a woman known for having a very sharp tongue and a bad temper. So perhaps that is what drove the great Socrates.
Yeah. Dude needed marriage counseling. Just
100%.
Big time.
You know, you guys, love languages, my man. Uh-huh. Just figure them out.
Next, in France, Article 171 of the Civil Code allows you to legally marry a person who is what? Is it A, already married to someone else? Is it B, under the age of 14? Or C, dead?
Oof. Oof. Well, I guess A.
I'm going with C.
Somehow that's the least disturbing of these three options.
I'm going with C, to marry somebody who's dead.
That is correct. It is called a posthumous marriage. You need permission from the president of France, and you have to prove you had intention of marrying them before they died.
Also, you know, depending on what that inheritance or that will says, I could see it. I could see it.
Yeah, how does that life insurance pay out?
I would be very curious to know situations in which this has actually taken place. All right, Montana.
Ooh,
the great state of Montana.
Ooh. It's a beautiful state.
I love Montana. I have spent much time there. Have family up there.
I would not spend a winter there.
No, it is wonderful from about May through September. Oof. And but there's some. What did you just? What phrase were you using earlier? Strange Oof. Business, weird. Oh, I would say
wild
weird,
business.
Wild business. I would say weird business takes place in Montana, including this. It is the only state that allows a double proxy marriage. What does that mean? Is it A, you can marry two people at once? B, neither the bride nor groom has to be at the wedding? Or C, your parents can legally get married for you?
Utah is like the centerpiece for our Mormon brothers and sisters, correct?
Yes, sir.
A.
little drift up north.
I'm going with the parents can get married for you.
You are both wrong on this one. The answer is actually
neither one
B,
have to be there.
Two stand-ins can say the vows for you.
Love that.
And it is mostly used by members of the military who are deployed overseas and want to get married but can't get leave.
Do you know I played soccer with a cow tongue in Montana? That's what they taught me.
Only in Montana.
Only in Montana.
Only in Montana.
Doesn't seem like you would roll very well.
Okay, I've lost track of who's winning, but...
I am.
Okay, I was pretty sure you were. Okay, couple more.
Relax.
In Samoa...
I am the greatest.
In Samoa, it is technically a crime for a husband to forget a specific date. Which date is it? Their wedding anniversary, A, B, Valentine's Day, or C, his wife's birthday?
Wedding anniversary. I'm going A.
I'll go his wife's birthday.
The correct answer is C. You said A, his wife's birthday.
I said the birthday.
Yeah, that is C. And while you probably won't do hard time, the law says the husband must clarify the mistake.
Clarify it.
And be required to pay a fine.
I like it.
Directly
I like
to the bride.
It. A little accountability. That's healthy. A
little bit. Okay, last one, although there are many fun ones that I'm skipping. In Wichita, Kansas... A specific family dispute is explicitly listed as not being a valid reason for divorce. So one of these reasons you cannot, says you may not get a divorce for this reason. Number one, is it because your spouse refuses to cook? Number two, is it because your spouse's mistreatment of your mother-in-law? Or is it your spouse snores too loudly?
Well, in ancient Jewish custom, that cooking one was one that would come up.
Oh, yes. I remember that.
I'm going to go with that.
Okay. That you're not allowed to get divorced
because they refuse to cook. You're not allowed to get divorced because they refuse to cook.
Okay. Josh?
Well, my extensive knowledge of the legal system of Wichita, Kansas...
does give you an advantage.
It does give me an advantage. And I actually have zero idea. What are the options again? So it's cook.
Refuses to cook, mistreats your mother-in-law, and snores too loudly.
I'm going to go with mistreats mother-in-law.
That is correct. The law basically says that just because your husband or wife is mean to your mom, that is not enough of a reason to legally end the marriage. Which I got to think there's a limit to that, though, right? Like
what constitutes as like mistreatment?
At some point.
If I murder mom,
like push her in front of a bus.
Feels like legitimate.
Hey, do y'all think that just like from your personal experience that like mistreatment of the parent-in-law, mother-in-law is a grounds for... like saying, hey, this isn't good for us. This isn't working out.
I don't know about that. I'll just say I know of situations where parent-in-law issues have been a significant factor in marriages having a very hard time.
I will say that I lucked out in having great in-laws, and even the quirks of the in-laws, I will take mine over 90% of the ones that I hear about every single day. Yeah. Christmas is coming up, so I am not saying anything different.
And wisdom.
And we really did luck out. I will say this, though, for those who are not married, get to know the in-laws and know what's happening. Because you marry families, you don't marry individuals.
100%. You are marrying
a
family.
It doesn't matter how little or how much... your spouse, future spouse is involved with them, you need to get to know who they are and figure out how do I make that work.
Absolutely. And I also am very fortunate in my in-law situation, and for that I am grateful. So that is some great pre-marriage advice there, Josh, at the end of our silly marriage trivia segment. Hope y'all enjoyed it. Josh, I believe you were the grand champion of marriage trivia. So
yes!
Well done.
I get
Judah.
To stay married.
It was rigged. I'm not married.
Better Why? Luck next time.
It's so stupid.
All right. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.
I don't talk about it.
Thank you.